day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your Warfarin conference call. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Diane Luxtrom. You may begin.
Okay. Thank you, Diane. Welcome. Thank you for joining the business series of teleconferences on warfarin safety. This is brought to you by IPRO. We at IPRO and the Medicare Prescription Drug Benefit Program are under contract with the CMS. We seek to improve the quality of health care and promote patient safety. We offer all our activities free of charge. This series on warfarin safety is an educational platform to promote the application of evidence-based practice. To this end, I am pleased to have Dr. Jeffrey Kennicott with us today. He will speak on managing residents who are on warfarin. The principles of management are applicable to any healthcare setting, like physicians' offices or hospitals, with the caveat that you are caring for an elderly person with the attendant pharmacophysiology that occurs with age. You are quite aware of the higher rate of infection in this population, so you are sure to appreciate Dr. Kennicott's discussion of treating a resident who has an infection, like a UTI or pneumonia, and who is chronically on warfarin. Please see Dr. Kennicott's presentation on our Joint Effort New York site. That's http://jenny.ipro.org/showthread.php?t=3495. Dr. Jeffrey Kennicott is currently Clinical Pharmacy Specialist in Infectious Diseases at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany, New York. He serves as adjunct faculty for Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences and a lecturer in Advanced Pharmacology at Sage College's Graduate School of Nursing. With his previous work in nursing care facilities, he brought a team focus in residential care, instituting comprehensive geriatric assessment and prescribing services. For those of you who have participated, listened in to our other programs, you know at the end of the presentation, we will have an open mic for questions and answers. Please take notes for this purpose. And meanwhile, your phones remain on mute. I believe that our service has muted your phones. I will also ask you to be kind and find the evaluation form either at the SurveyMonkey site link or the Joint Effort New York site. These links you will find on the last slide. Thank you again, Dr. Kennicott. I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here and speaking about long-term care and things that I've really spent quite a bit of my career in pharmacy working with. Brief history, I started in long-term care consultation in the 1980s and also worked with a dispensing pharmacy back then. We had many residents to manage, and that was kind of the beginning of when computerized MAR forms and physician order sheets were being provided by a pharmacy service to various nursing facilities. And even though I work in a hospital today, I seem to be involved in some of the same things that I did as a consultant pharmacist back then. And that would be rounding through the nursing home, taking a pharmacist look at things, and making recommendations to prescribers and nursing about ideas that may improve the patient's care or the resident's care. I do the same thing that I did in long-term care with infectious disease at St. Peter's today. And I guess I'm lucky to be able to do those types of things. I certainly enjoy it very much, and the challenges never seem to stop. So let's get started. We're going to talk about the challenges of warfarin therapy in elderly nursing home patients and discuss some tools and systems that nursing homes can use and also understand how to implement and maintain a program of nursing home INR and warfarin drug interaction monitoring. I think because of this lecture series, many of you have heard lectures about why we use warfarin in long-term care. In my first few slides leading right up to the case on slides 14, I'm not going to spend much time on. These are things that we can go back and question and answer and solve, or actually I think that they might be redundant for many of the participants in the audience. But I want to highlight one thing on slide number 3. And that is that elderly residents in long-term care represent an ideal setting for management with laboratory monitoring on hand, compliance, dose adjustment, and interacting medications, all well controlled. It's a wonderful platform to provide superior care, that being long-term care. And you also have the requisite professionals on hand. You have, from my point of view, a consulting pharmacist that's mandated by CMS, as well as a dispensing pharmacist resource. You have a nurse. You have medical practitioners, whether they be physicians, NPs, or PAs. And you have, of course, a patient, and the patient's always an important component in the care that's delivered. Slide 4. If you look at warfarin in long-term care, though, the literature reports that community hospitals, ambulatory care, and nursing homes all seem to have trouble keeping patients in the therapeutic range, and basically that's about 50% of the time. And nursing homes don't represent a superior level of care if you look at the way this is measured. Other folks have picked up on the idea or the importance of warfarin monitoring and warfarin use and managing such. You have various programs, not to leave off IPRO and this SWAT program for improving the safety of warfarin. And you also have Joint Commission. Whether or not you're accredited or not, the information from the Joint Commission is consistent with what we're going to talk about today, and it's certainly not any service or level of service that's over the top from my point of view. Slide four. Looking at warfarin, just a brief review, as a pharmacist, I just love the pharmacology part, but we are going to zip along here. First, we have to remember that what we're doing is we're trying to use a drug, warfarin, to interfere with a natural process, and that process is the production of functional clotting factors. It's going along just fine without warfarin, and warfarin basically wants to put a brake on the process. It wants to slow down the production. If we were to completely interfere with the process, we would have INRs that are greater than 20. We would have huge INRs, and of course, that's not the balance we're looking for. Warfarin, by nature, is a very tricky compound to use because we're trying to slow the vehicle down a little bit, but not necessarily stop it, and we want to maintain our speed, whether we're going uphill or downhill all the time. We need to maintain PT and INR within specific range. Remember that warfarin, for the pharmacists and physicians and medical people out there especially, is a compound that comes with two optical isomers, S and R. And S, of course, is the more potent form of warfarin and the one that's largely affected more often by drug interactions directly that impair S warfarin's metabolism. Slide 6 is about clotting factors that we're trying to impair, and they have their own biological half-lives. Really, this slide serves to just remind us that we can start warfarin today, but its effect is not often measured, at least by PT and INR, and really in a desirable way, as the guidelines and such will tell us, until about 48 to 72 hours. The existing procoagulation factors have to actually be eliminated before a change in production is actually felt in the system. With patient monitoring, we use PT-INR. INR is an international normalized ratio, which tries to get us all on the same page. But our targets are fairly consistent. Most patients are trying to achieve a target of 2.5 INR. Maybe if they have a mechanical heart valve or a higher risk, they have a target goal of 3.0. Common knowledge is that we should measure every 3 days during an initiation for the first week until the patient stabilized anyway, and then optimally every 4 weeks thereafter. Slide 8. INR is prone to failures. Target INR achievement, as I stated earlier, is around 50% of the time on average when you look at people's averages, and that means it's difficult. And the difficulties are not without severe risk to the patient. Morbidity and mortality is definitely accelerated in the form of hemorrhage with excessive INRs. However, bleeding can occur at any INR. The risk are particularly is particularly seen in the elderly. Age is an important risk factor. And the risk of bleeding episodes increases when INR is excessively elevated, especially intracranial bleeding. Slide 8. Slide 9. The relationship of the intensity of treatment and the risk of adverse event has been evaluated using time in the therapeutic range. And guidelines tell us that a systematic method of managing these patients is really what we should be seeking. And that systematic method is achievable in long-term care, and we're going to talk about it further. I think it's easier than perhaps in a hospital or in a home care setting. Slide 10. With these elderly folks, we have guidelines that tell us to use less when certain comorbidities exist. Slide 11. And that type of dosing might look like this, where if a patient has no basic risk factors such as congestive heart failure or other risk factors, we would start with 5 milligrams. But if they have basic risk factors, we'd start with 2 to 4. We want to see a slow ramp up, not an immediate effect, and dosing guidelines that have been published in the literature, many different forms, look something like this. But remember, we are practitioners who take care of elderly people. And there is, if you will, an octogenarian, an 80 to 90-year-old, who is much more functional and much healthier than another. And there's a wide disparity between people who are certain ages and as far as their biology and their pharmacology and how drugs affect them. And we're going to try to get into a little bit of that. So in other words, we all know there are fragile elderly and not so fragile elderly, and this affects warfarin, and this makes warfarin guidelines and writing guidelines specifically that are age-based basically impossible. We have to apply the art of medicine, and we have to apply not just good normal or good appropriate parameters to prescribing, but we have to feel through what is this patient's specific individual needs, and we're going to talk about developing a system that supports that. Slide 12, patient management of a subtherapeutic INR looks something like this, that you would want to increase that dose between 10 and 20% of its weekly cumulative dose. I think this has been covered in previous lectures. And one of the points I want to make is I found this to be overlooked in long-term care because people, when they're taking a 2 milligrams a day or a total of 14 milligrams per week, 10% change is not very much. That would be basically increasing the dose to 15.5 milligrams. A 20% change would be 17 milligrams per week. That's a very modest dose change. The problem is the tablets come as 2.5 and 3, and if a practitioner was to grab one of those and just change from 2 milligrams daily to 2.5 milligrams daily, they basically exceed the 20% upper limit of what most dosing guidelines would suggest. And that's important because I see that often overlooked. And also, people might jump from 2 to 3 milligrams per day, yielding 21 milligrams per week, an extravagantly high percentage dosage increase, which would yield, of course, probably results that increase the INR before much greater than the 1 point unit that would be expected with a 10 to 20% range increase. Slide 13. Patient management with an elevated INR is reflected very well, I think, in the CHEST guidelines that are posted on this slide. When patients aren't bleeding, they're often managed in the long-term care setting. And that management is omitting a dose, holding a dose, lowering a dose. Management might also include vitamin K. Vitamin K for INRs 5 to 9 would be between the dosage range of 1 to 2.5 milligrams PO, perhaps, and also holding next doses of warfarin. Greater than 9, vitamin K dose 2.5 to 5 milligrams PO. So this is all in the literature, and I'm sure very readily available to you. Slide 14 is where the case begins. And so here we go. We have A.H., a 91-year-old nursing home resident with a presumed cystitis UTI. I'm sure this patient's very familiar to all of you out there, as this scenario really comes up quite often. A new prescription for Bactrim was written. That Bactrim is DS-1PO-Q12H for 7 days for UTI, and an order came along with it, fortunately, to draw PTINR in 3 days. This patient's history includes chronic warfarin use at 2 milligrams per day and recent hospitalization for a bronchitis event and a known congestive heart failure diagnosis and exacerbation along with that bronchitis and hospitalization. Unfortunately, the patient's been losing weight recently and has had a significant weight loss and currently weighs only 103 pounds. She has dietary provisions that allow a soft pureed diet and dietary is trying to improve her weight problem with Ensure, PRN, and we need to note, though, that this diet change is present. Her INR 20 days ago was 2.3 within the therapeutic range for her particular condition, and hemoglobin 38%, platelets 215, albumin 2.7. All of those lab indices were grabbed 3 months ago. Slide 15. This, I hope, is a process that's somewhat familiar to most of you. The pharmacy picks up on the fact that Bactrim interacts with warfarin. Bactrim interacts with the metabolism of warfarin and will raise S-warfarin serum levels sometimes quite significantly. And we probably will see a significant increase in the INR if that interaction is allowed to come to play for a reasonable period of time. That period of time varies between residents. So the pharmacy detects the interaction and sends out a written drug interaction warning statement to the nursing home with the drug delivery. The evening RN accepts that delivery and reviews and places the pharmacist warning statement in the clinic list for the nurse practitioner to review in the morning. And the next day, the MD or nurse practitioner records the PTINR, reorders the PTINR in 3 days. So, slide 16. At day 3, the PTINR was not drawn, and therefore the result was not available. Unfortunately, no one noticed that it wasn't drawn. And then on day 6 of the interacting therapy, Bactrim with warfarin on day 6, the INR was routinely drawn. It was the phlebotomy knew that they needed to do this. It's just a coincidence, and the INR came back elevated, most likely due to the drug interaction at 5.4. A phone call because of the panic level for the INR was made to a practitioner. The practitioner from that phone call at home stated the following: DC warfarin, give vitamin K 10 milligrams now, and draw a PT and INR tomorrow morning. I hope that this type of response is something that many of you have seen before. We're going to pick it apart. We're going to have some fun with this. On slide 17, some of you are probably saying things like, well, what's going on here with this antibiotic interaction? Are there really any antibiotics which are safe? And, of course, we have from an improvement standpoint, and I think a very appropriate one that I'm passionate about with IPRO, is that system improvements are needed to assure that patients who require concomitant warfarin and antibiotics receive additional monitoring necessary to maintain the INR within the therapeutic range. So what are those types of systems? Let's kind of go through this first. The first thing I'd like to say is let's just take a look at error in drug interactions. And there are many layers, and this is that Swiss cheese diagram. This is slide 18, the Swiss cheese diagram, which ends up in the patient being affected by an adverse drug reaction. It has to go through many layers and many different providers and many different systems, computer systems, prescriber's knowledge, pharmacist knowledge. I don't even think all the factors are listed here, and we certainly have many. We have about 8 or 9. What I want to say is that I imagine most of you are familiar with actually seeing these ADRs occur, and I'd like to talk about some of the factors about why they do. Key factors would be referring to slide 20, not slide 19. Jump ahead to 20 for me. Key factors would be probably represented by a slide like this. You might recognize the slide from earlier in the presentation where I said that S warfarin is the potent form of warfarin, and it's the one affected by Bactrim in this Bactrim interaction. It's a strong interaction which would cause the patient to have less activated vitamin K, allowing less functional clotting factors. But over on the left-hand side, you see all these things in red that also impact this. And this is the difference between perhaps a young patient and an older patient. And more accurately, this is the difference between a patient that has a lot of disease and comorbidity and a patient that doesn't have a lot of disease and comorbidity. The purity of the drug interaction is modified greatly by most geriatric residents. Age is a risk factor for people having an elevated INR. Body size, nutritional status, liver disease, renal disease, thyroid disease, and many of these things come into play with the elderly geriatric resident. Hence, guidelines like the CHEST guidelines for use of vitamin K antagonists say use smaller doses. They also say that there's a relationship between the body mass index, age, and serum albumin, which is probably the first three things are linked together, but yet they're listed as separate risk factors for elevated INRs when using warfarin. Other things we ought to think about is, so why don't we maybe measure routine plasma K levels and vitamin K levels? That's not recommended. It's not something that we routinely do. We look more at other variables like PTINR. Vitamin K can vary a lot in the elderly. Malnutrition, reduced dietary intake, things like chronic illness, long-term TPN treatments, things like that, antibiotics that alter gastrointestinal flora, not just a direct interaction with metabolism, but one that affects vitamin K production by gut bacteria. All of these things impact the elderly and probably in a much more significant manner. We know that. It's hard to measure, though. Basically, patients who eat a vitamin K-depleted diet, which would be less than 2 servings of green leafy vegetables a day, are at risk. They're at risk for having instability and variations in INR. The liver plays a critical role, liver disease, where it's the clotting factor producer, but changes in blood flow and the health of the liver change clotting blood factor production, as you might assume, as well as albumin. Hypoalbuminemia, it's a protein-bound drug, also affects how patients respond to warfarin. Renal disease has been linked. I looked at patients in my long-term care facilities with St. Peter's in the last few years. The average Cockcroft-Gault renal excretion for an average resident was about 41 mils per minute, given our population. And that's not unusual. That is renal compromise. That is significant renal compromise. And that's an average patient. There are many patients who, of course, are much less than that, and not many that are much better than that. What else did I want to say here? Genetics have been looked at. Patients vary in their ability to metabolize drugs and have variations to that respect. However, genetic testing widespread in clinical care has not been very well validated and is not at this time strongly recommended by the FDA as a primary tactic to improve the use of warfarin. So looking now back at slide 19, our case. The patient has Bactrim warfarin. They have recent weight loss with a change in albumin, most likely, protein binding changes. They have a change in diet because they haven't been eating as well. They've lost weight. These are things where the patient can interact. You don't always have to just rely on nursing to give you this information or dietary to write a note in the chart. These are things that you can ask the patient directly when the patient's able to tell you these things. And, of course, we have recent acute illness. The patient has recently been hospitalized. Also a marker that should always be weighed in one's assessment of how things could change with the use of warfarin. Other issues happened. Remember, the INR draw was missed. And, by the way, whose job is it to detect a lot of things? First, whose job was it to determine that the INR was not drawn? Is it the pharmacist? Is it the nurses? Is it the primary care provider? Questions like that probably need to be looked at when people look at their processes and try to put a team together as far as how to manage these folks. The fact that the patient was prescribed Bactrim for UTI plays right into my current responsibilities in infectious disease. As you all know, you've all seen literature that UTIs are thought to be, in a way, I think the word is grossly overtreated in the long-term care setting. UTIs, it's been an improvement objective of other organizations to improve the diagnosis of UTIs using standardized criteria, and to make sure that you aren't treating asymptomatic bacteria, make sure you're not treating just basically bacteria in the urine. The take-home message is patients need to have symptoms. And you have to be able to assess a patient for symptoms, whether or not they truly have a UTI. This patient may not have had any drug interaction problems whatsoever if you'd avoided the use of Bactrim to begin with. And what about alternative drugs to Bactrim for UTI? What about the duration of treatment for this patient? Are three-day therapies for a UTI an acceptable treatment provision for the long-term care resident? We'll try to talk a little bit more about that as we go along. Jumping down to slide 20, we start with solutions. And I think what I wanted to say with this slide, most importantly, is the first step is the hardest step, and that's getting started. If you're in an institution right now that's already trying to prove warfarin, congratulations. And the use of warfarin and management of drug interactions, I think that's very, very exemplary and a wonderful thing to be doing. I also know that we all have precious time. We have a lot of problems to manage. And part of the problem is it seems like there must be over 100 different drug interactions with warfarin. How do we know when to apply improvement goals and when not to? It seems like just about any drug you give with warfarin interacts with it, and not all patients obviously react with increased INRs and PT-INRs. So how do we get this program up and running, and how do we make sure it's a durable and useful and sustainable patient care program? I like to say with slide 22 that really quality improvement committees are really the universal leverage tool because they have all the important ingredients. They have administration to back and to provide energy and focus. They have resources. You have nursing and medical staff. And I believe pharmacists must also be an active member of a quality improvement committee, given the amount of medication that's used in a nursing facility and certainly requisite to warfarin, one of the more complicated drugs anybody has ever tried to manage. Along the lines of quality improvement committees, looking at slide 23, there are many indices or indicators which could be contrived to measure the quality of warfarin use and management. And I've listed what I feel are some of the most important ones. But let's jump down a little bit. Why would we avoid root cause analysis when we can use root cause analysis for any sort of a drug interaction that may or had the strong potential to cause patient harm? Now, we know that patient harm in the form of warfarin and supertherapeutic INRs is an intracranial bleed, high morbidity, high mortality, high patient cost. So warfarin fits as far as criteria for really looking at how did something happen. But you can manage all sorts of aspects of warfarin or look at the quality of that, and that is the quality of increasing the dose or managing supertherapeutic doses of warfarin and how that's managed. There's compliance percentages with the use of antimicrobial order forms or forms that are associated with the monitoring of warfarin itself. There are vitamin K orders that can be looked at. All of these things can be used as tools to drive a philosophy and to garner a certain amount of energy in a long-term care institution for appreciating warfarin and warfarin problems as a problem and not just that something that happens along the way with the use of warfarin. Looking at slide 24 and specifically drug interactions, as I mentioned earlier, it takes a little bit of time often for a drug interaction to change the PT-INR. And therefore, often those changes aren't seen until about 3 days. And we have a problem with warfarin interactions as far as too many. We have multitudes of drugs that interfere with warfarin. And as I said earlier, take a look at slide 25, which is a screenshot of one program's warning statement that would come to a nursing facility. And there's basically there's too much information that comes on these things. It's a huge document. I've only taken a small snippet of it here. This is a summary statement. But often pharmacies need to take a look at what they're communicating and how they're communicating it. Nowhere on this does it remind a practitioner of a facility-specific protocol that an INR should be gotten, whether that protocol states in 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, whatever the facility picks. Any of those are probably reasonable ideas, although it needs to be tailor-matched to a patient. I believe there are patients that would need in monitoring drug interaction, perhaps the one that we've chosen because of her multiple comorbidities with recent hospitalization, poor vitamin K intake and weight loss, and poor PO intake, maybe she needs closer monitoring. These are all things that people can work out the very minute details with their existing medical staff and pharmacy staff. But again, this is a warning that comes across, and it's not very specific, and it's loaded with too much information and not enough specific information. We can write, pharmacies have maybe a hedge here. They're saying, oh, gee, I must distribute because of our internal process, I must distribute this document. But pharmacies don't have to limit what they send. They could also send a document that draws attention to that facility's specific protocol. On number 26, computerized drug interaction alerts, I'd like to just draw attention to the fact that they are lacking in sensitivity and specificity, and that they basically, I think, many prescribers, many pharmacists, and many nurses have become desensitized because of the high volume. That aspect right there could be a whole nother talk, and this has been reported and looked at very closely in the literature already. So to desensitize, we have to use appropriate education and maybe change things around to improve quality, especially if it's not currently working. And with education, looking at slides 27 and 28, these are items that have already been promoted and put together and available to you. They are very accurate. Both of these look at the interacting antimicrobials. It looks at really case reports in the case of slide number 27, and also its propensity to or direction of anticoagulant effect on slide number 28. They're not comprehensive lists, but they're certainly common antimicrobial lists that are represented in long-term care, and a very nice job well done to IPRO on that one. Looking at the bottom of slide number 28, read, the SWOT project goal is that every warfarin user who is prescribed a potentially interacting antibiotic will have their INR tested within 3 to 7 days. I like that. And we're going to play along with that a little bit. But looking over the information that has also been put on here, I'd just like to draw attention to some of the problems also or gaps with slide number 29. And that is that we have inconsistent FDA guidance with proprietary drug interaction programs. Nothing really matches up with warfarin. You can look at one proprietary program versus another, and everybody gives different information about drug interactions and their strength of their significance and their propensity to actually occur. Things jump around. If you line them all up, and I had this in an earlier version of this report that we're giving today, there's quite a bit of disparity. Take a look at this recent announcement by the FDA that made Zithromax, azithromycin, put a potential interaction warning with warfarin in their package insert. The fact of the matter is that Zithromax, azithromycin, really doesn't interfere with the metabolism of warfarin in any way. And the idea is that why did the FDA require this type of information to be put in there and the way that they put it in there as a potential drug interaction? Many authors, and myself included, think that the actual interaction is with infection. And in an acutely ill patient with fever, which would often be seen when you use azithromycin for a bronchitis or a pneumonia, you're going to see fever, and you're going to see a significantly ill patient that's reacting to the insult of an infection. And you have a lot of cytokines that are released. That cytokine stimulation and change in production of clotting factors, active viable clotting factors is a very strong component of what happens perhaps with a lot of elderly residents who are very fragile as far as their clotting factor production. It pushes them over into a higher INR response. It seemingly is triggered by the drug that caused it, which is what pharmacists always seem to think of as it's always a drug problem, when actually it's not. It's probably a fever and acute illness problem. I don't want to leave out, though, how we ought to look at elevated INRs, or excuse me, abnormal PT-INRs, and some of the things that also go wrong. How about blood drawn on slide 30 from a wrong patient? Laboratory inaccuracies. Wrong tube. It has to be a light blue tube. That tube needs to be refrigerated, and that sample needs to be processed within 4 hours. All of these types of things can enter into the equation and will probably should precipitate a double check if things don't line up clinically. Poor patient compliance. Well, a nursing home is an excellent place to assess something like that. We use MARs. We have people assisting with medication delivery, and we probably ought to look at that also. Initiation or cessation of an interacting drug, of course, that's what we're talking about here in some ways. Dietary changes, recent illness. You know, the idea with this slide number 30 is a team should have these types of things embedded in their process for evaluating warfarin and an abnormal INR. Now, what are the various roles of these members on the team? Looking at slide number 31, whose job is it? Well, the role of the consultant pharmacist really has very many different responsibilities. And this, by the way, is not the concurrent review pharmacist who's looking at the drug order and keying in a new drug order on a patient's profile. This is more the consultant pharmacist providing that drug regimen review, coming over to the facility, working with the nursing staff, working with the resident, and working with the prescribers. But looking also at whose role is it or whose job is it to manage these folks with INRs, slide number 32. This is straight out of some literature for consultant pharmacy, something that I've been involved in all my career. A consultant pharmacist, looking at item slide number 32, item number 2, is responsible for identifying over-medicated and under-medicated patient situations. Sounds something like what we're talking about. Monitoring possible drug interactions, number 3. Determining if and when the patient's medication schedules or types of medication need to be adjusted. All of these things seem to fit into what we're talking about with warfarin. But consultant pharmacists aren't always completely available for these types of things. What we have is a situation where often maybe their contract is quite limiting. Maybe they've entered an agreement with a nursing facility where their services, even though consultant pharmacists say we have to do all these services, the fact of the matter is they have a very, very high patient load. Their contract doesn't allow, maybe, things like this. These are things that actually can evolve or change as a result of problems with medications. Just because there's a certain dogma in a certain geographic area like Albany, New York, or wherever you happen to be listening from, where it seems like consultant pharmacists all do this the same way, there are other ways, and there are many different ways. I personally had the pleasure of being involved in a facility where I was able to spend several days a week at a 160-bed nursing home, and I was able to put together rounding teams not just for psychiatry but also for high-risk drugs, i.e. warfarin. And when you start looking at systemic approaches or systematic approaches on slide 33, it starts really with a warfarin monitoring form. I don't really care what that monitoring form exactly embodies or even where it exactly exists. It may exist in a patient's chart. It may exist in a medication administration record. It might even exist in a separate book. All of those things, if it fits a facility's process for managing a patient like this, work. But I think you have to have a warfarin monitoring form, and you have to have a list, if you will, by having a monitoring form that's readily available and maintained routinely of patients that are on this high-risk medication called warfarin. A team prepares the form. Anyone can enter it. A pharmacist can put information on it, but logically, it's a nursing home, and nurses largely enter much of the information on the monitoring form for the warfarin. But the nurse the medical provider, and the pharmacist can all look at it. The key is to have it be a part of your normal routine, to have it be a part of your responsibilities. There are other systematic approaches which can be used for warfarin, which include the use of daily drug use notification reports. A pharmacy and a pharmacist dispense medications to a facility, let's say on a 7 day a week, every 24 hour blocks of time. And those reports can be generated and distributed on a daily basis also. So reports that sort and sift and find interacting medications for warfarin residents are not that difficult to customize and to produce for many pharmacy providers. And they can certainly be critical in helping a facility maximize efficiency and identify patients at risk for possible drug interactions. Dispensing of drugs of interest notification, antimicrobials that have been dispensed. I happen to use antimicrobial dispensing in my hospital. I use some lists where I look at drug interactions, but I also look at patients on certain certain floors and certain services. Nothing there is extraordinary as far as patient management in long-term care facilities. If you're using a patient management process for rehab beds that's different than a patient for long-term care beds, that's probably potentially realistic. Subacute step-down patients often are a little bit more fragile as far as their recent surgery, their recent blood loss, their recent loss in functional capacity, and their need for rehabilitation and strengthening to get back. Maybe they're a little bit more susceptible in some respects. But all of the time, there are basic drug daily use reports that can help you assess and assemble a process of care for managing these situations. The telephone works well. Consultant pharmacists, whether they are in the facility or not, can often be consulted as far as dose changes and things like that. And I like patient status changes going into things like this. I think sick days, weight loss, diarrhea, nausea, things that affect eating, all of these are important patient status changes that can affect the provision of how warfarin affects the patient, as we've had a little bit of time to talk about earlier. I'd like to also, before we go along too much further, talk about slide number 34. A facility can put together an antibiogram, which helps tailor antimicrobials as far as susceptibility patterns to the isolates that have been gathered at that facility, and your micro lab can help with that. Slide 35, common infections in long-term care. Antimicrobial order sheets probably ought to address these infections. And even though a lecture about appropriate infection treatment in using antimicrobials in this context today is far beyond the scope of what I could possibly deliver, maybe it bears some consideration. Because short treatment courses have not been well studied in the elderly, and there is an increasing pieces of evidence appearing in the literature because of the importance of appropriate antimicrobial stewardship with using shorter courses of antimicrobial for certain diagnoses. And UTI is not excluded from that. Not only is appropriate diagnosis and adhering to criteria to begin with important to avoid treating patients who really aren't infected, you can also get away with three-day treatment courses in uncomplicated cystitis-type UTIs, patients that really don't have situations which would make them more of a complicated course. Number 36 is here's an example of an antibiotic and infection management, quote, antimicrobial order sheet. These order sheets can be put together, and in the order sheet, if you'll look in about the fourth box down, you can embed lab orders, okay? So a process of care in a nursing home could be that this order sheet must be used for all antimicrobials that are ordered. All antimicrobials must be put through this order sheet. Whether that be a verbal order, a written order, or a telephone order, this sheet must be grabbed and used for all antimicrobials. It greatly improves why the antimicrobial is being used. This type of thing would be transmitted or faxed to the pharmacy. The pharmacist is further in the treatment plan as far as the point of order entry. So many things are so much better. And look at the lab with respect to the lab orders for antimicrobials for patients that are concurrently on chronic warfarin therapy. There it is. It's right on the order sheet. So if it's a phone call that's occurring between the nurse and physician, then so be it. Let that information come forward in the phone call already. I'm going to skip over slide 37, and I'm going to go on to our case in slide number 38. Chapter 2, the RN calls the physician to report a critical INR value of 5.4. We knew this already, but remember the assessment that the patient is currently not bleeding. And there we have our order for 10 milligrams of vitamin K, and stop that warfarin immediately. If we look at this slide number 39, I think this is really redundant. I've gone through the patient's risk factors and variables, but again, it's vitamin K that's the rescue medication, and it's vitamin K that we're trying to impair. It's complicated to use the right amount of vitamin K, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it in slide number 40. So patient management of an elderly patient using vitamin K. Even the vitamin K is mixed up here. This patient only had an INR of 5.4. And if we had a protocol or a guideline is probably the better word to use in long-term care because protocols are hard to implement. Rules and regulations of protocol usage in various states differ. And it's not easy to do that in New York State. But anyway, with vitamin K, patients become very easily resistant to warfarin with vitamin K. So if one was to use 10 milligrams of vitamin K, you can set up a situation where the patient would be resistant to warfarin for up to 1 week. Well, of course, sometimes that means that when the patient is retitrated to a normal INR, that people have to raise the dose of warfarin, or they think that they need to raise the dose of warfarin. It's very difficult to counter the effects of vitamin K resistance, which will wear off over time, a week or so or greater. But if you set that up to fail basically by using too much, then you've already set yourself behind the eight ball. And I see I've just kicked over the point where we ought to be starting our question and answer period. But I'm just going to, just bear with me. I have one more slide that I kind of want to go through, and that's slide number 41. And that'll be a bit of a summary, and then we'll have our question and answers. So slide 41, systematic solutions. Implementing a warfarin monitoring form and using it on a daily basis. In other words, there is a nurse champion, a nurse practitioner or medical practitioner, or a pharmacist, or maybe some combination for various aspects of the usage of these forms, but their assessment and look at the patient is really a key or fundamental step in how to improve the use of warfarins in long-term care. People can construct guidelines for PT-INR monitoring. The SWOT program has pointed to one. You will have an INR, PT-INR, within 3 to 7 days of prescribing of an antibiotic in a chronic warfarin managed patient. You need to take a look at your processes and assign staff to how this monitoring plan is managed and implemented. And most likely, you'll need a pharmacist or a champion or a nurse or a prescriber who's sensitive to the unique needs and vulnerabilities of the elderly to provide some education and to look at the staff. Also, if there's a lot of prescribers in a facility, they don't always act the same way. They don't always make the same level of decisions. Pharmacists are not all the same. Nurses are not all the same. None of us is the same. And there may be some of us who are much more logical to be warfarin champions or fluent in the use of warfarin. And those people need to be selected out. And maybe also importantly, the ones who don't seem to pay attention to warfarin need to be identified and selected out. That type of thing can be identified in quality improvement through prescribing patterns and event analysis. And you need to hold people accountable. You can't just do all this work and then not have a way to intervene and talk to people when things seem to be falling apart or not working. I like the use of antimicrobial order forms. It's a project that I've done in long-term care before, and I think it helps with the warfarin patient specifically because of the presence where you can limit the duration of therapy. You can design certain therapies to hit your antibiogram. And importantly, with a warfarin patient, those lab orders to make sure you get an INR. You can tailor computerized alerts to the pharmacist, and the pharmacist can tailor computerized alerts and responses to the nursing home and to the key caregivers. And with that, I'd like to conclude, and that leaves us at least 10 minutes for question and answer. Thank you for being such a attentive audience, and I apologize a little bit. It seemed like a lot of material to handle in a short period of time, and there's certainly various lectures embedded within some of the concepts here. Thank you very much. Diane, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you. Operator, Diane, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
So can you ask the participants if there's any questions? I believe they have to hit star 6 to open their line. Is that how it goes?
It's star 1.
Oh, star 1, sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then 1 on your touchtone telephone. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then 1 on your touchtone telephone.
Okay, well, I'm on the moderator line, and I do have a question. It's not something that you covered, Jeff, but I'm curious. I manage my mom's warfarin therapy, and she's 82, and she's on a very low dose, 1 milligram a day. And I'm wondering what you're thinking about, and she's within her therapeutic range at that dose. How much do you think is the genetic component to her ability to have such a low dose and be in therapeutic range? Have you read anything about that?
That is a very interesting idea, because if she's stable at that range and she's getting a good diet and she's really a responsible eater as far as our vegetables and leafy greens and vitamin K content. And she requires such a small dose of warfarin, one would have to sort of take a look at, wow, this must be a poor metabolizer. Certainly that test is available, and you would probably look for that patient to be an S-warfarin-impaired metabolizer. But the way I look at it is, well, if we know that information, how does going to that trouble and gathering that information change the way we would manage the patient? And if what I said is already intact, it doesn't. And it's just adds to maybe a solution. I know we all like to know the answer to everything, and we could pretend that we have all the answers with that information, but if it doesn't really change the solution, that because the other things are in place as far as good diet and such and consistency, I don't think it really has a strong place.
Yeah. I was just kind of wondering about, you know, what if I, by chance, developed AFib emergently and had to be placed on warfarin? Would it be an interesting item that I would want to tell my provider, you know, that my mother has a very low dose of warfarin? Don't start me on 5, you know? I don't know. It's just a thought I had.
You have a lot of insight to this.
Well, it's something I think about all the time because I'm managing her and feeding her and, you know, taking care of her. So,
the idea there you might scare away that provider, might get them nervous, but I'm only kidding.
Do that anyway.
It's not an unreasonable concept. It's genetics. And secondly, in a hospitalized situation, it's daily INRs. Okay, when we initiate and we get somebody going on warfarin, it's a daily INR. And if your INR, if that patient's INR jumps inappropriately within the first 17 to 24 hours of warfarin dose, we're going to react to that. We're going to say, wait a minute, what happened here? And we're gonna analyze it and try to take it back.
Thank you.
And I'm showing that we have a question from the phone line. And our first question comes from Hyacin Lopez. You may ask your question.
Yes. I have a question. Have you seen any major differences in obtaining therapeutic level when using generic generic brand, the generic versus the brand?
Wow, okay. So the question is, have you seen a difference in the way warfarin behaves when patients are changed from a brand name to a generic? And that is a very interesting question. I would have to say, yes, I have seen patients who seem to behave differently when we switch them from one brand to a generic. But that's actually the concept. If you remember back there on that slide, where was that back in there, where I talked about assessing a patient, and part of that assessment was noting if a brand of the warfarin had changed. That would be slide. Anyway, I'm gonna answer it. It's not necessarily, in my opinion, there is very little evidence to support buying a branded drug versus a generic. It's when the form or manufacturer of the warfarin itself changes. So if a pharmacy is using different generics, you might experience the same thing. The consistency with a branded product is it's the same manufacturing process and the same provider. But patients presumably might differently. But I wouldn't hone in or really get too excited about making patients dispenses written only. I would just be careful about switching patients around back and forth through various brands.
Thank you. Could you also expatiate on the treatment of UTI for 3 days? I'm not sure if you had elaborated on that.
Yes, I wanted to spend so much more time on that. Thank you. Give me a good shot at it here. So with urinary tract infections, and if you look at the Infectious Disease Society of America guidelines and various guidelines that have been written for short course therapies with urinary tract infection, I don't have it in front of me, but I have to talk about this, so I'll try to quote. The quote would be that studies with the elderly have largely not been conducted. Now, and therefore, a practitioner would probably like to most likely use 7-day treatments because 3-day has not been adequately tested in geriatric patients. However, despite the guideline providing a sort of a hedge, not a very high qualified or high quality of information as far as not using 3-day treatments in elderly folks, just the fact that there's a paucity of information. And however, I have personal experience where you know that you're looking at a very simple cystitis, and you're able to take a look at a urine sample prior to treatment and a UA and a urine sample at 3 days of treatment. If that urine is cleared, you can stop therapy. That's one aspect of looking at this. And if you've had the opportunity to treat a lot of elderly, you will know that that patient's symptoms have largely resolved and that they are back. Everything seems to be back where they should be. So there is room to try 3-day therapies. The drugs that work good with 3-day therapies are the fluoroquinolones. Mm-hmm. They work quite well, the Cipro and the Levaquin, as well as the Bactrim. Those are both 3-day type drugs. The macrodantin, which is largely contraindicated because of renal function in elderly, not a good candidate. That's a 7-day treatment. It didn't even do well with young folks, nor did the drug cephalexin, Keflex, work well in less than 7 days with younger patients.
Thank you. That's it.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then one on your touchtone telephone. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then one on your touchtone telephone. Okay, I'm showing no further questions in queue. You may continue.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jeff. That was just terrific. I'll be sending, for any other comments, hopefully the participants can email me, and I'll forward it to you if you don't mind.
That's very reasonable. I'd be happy.
Okay, that's terrific. And thank you, everyone, for joining us in the Warfarin Series teleconference. And that's it. Goodbye.